Remember those endless summer days that felt like they just last forever? Sun rays kiss your skin, grass tickles your toes as you bite into the creamy popsicle melting in your hand. Pure, unbothered bliss. Capture more sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. This nostalgic vanilla flavor with notes of candied orange can help keep you hydrated while savoring your favorite golden hour moments. No matter how hot your summer gets, just one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than water alone. It's 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, with 8 vitamins and nutrients for refreshing on-the-go hydration. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. That's code INDULGE20 at liquidiv.com.
Hi, everyone. Although we moved on from 1977, we haven't moved on from the multiple homicides. Today, however, instead of discussing a string of murders, we're focusing on the Blackfriars massacre that occurred on June 28th, 1978.
I know we've said this before when we've covered high-profile cases, but I'll just say it again. It is very difficult to provide our listeners with a different perspective because there have been so many well-done articles, videos, and podcasts put out over the years.
So, and I'm often reluctant to do these episodes, but this case was the talk of the town back then and a constant source of speculation and theory. So I felt it was necessary. Hopefully we can present some of the lesser known things today.
I agree. We always try, so let's get started. It's going to be a long one, you guys, so grab a drink or something.
Sorry, guys.
5 men of different backgrounds were slain that June evening in the Blackfriars pub on Summer Street in downtown Boston. They were found in the basement of the club by the janitor, Jerry Robinson, the following morning. Each had been shot in the head with either a 12-gauge shotgun and or a 25-caliber automatic handgun. 2 of the bodies were so badly damaged by the ammo that they had to be identified by their fingerprints. The men slain that evening were Vincent Solmonti, age 35, the owner of the Blackfriars pub, Peter Marith, age 31, of Jamaica Plain, Freddie De La Vega, age 34, of Somerville, Charles McGarian, age 37, of North Andover, and John Jack Kelly, age 34, club manager and former local TV newsman.
Do you want to start out by profiling the men before we actually talk about the crime itself, then the investigation, suspects, trial, aftermath, and so on?
That sounds good to me. So I want to start with Jack Kelly, the manager. By the way, it is very confusing that his name is Jack Kelly.
And should not be confused with our Jack Kelly.
Definitely not. John A. Kelly was born on November 30th, 1943 in Philadelphia to Francis G. Kelly and Rose Mary Lally. Both of his parents were originally from New Jersey. The family relocated to Brighton, Mass. In 1952. Kelly joined the Air Force in 61. He was deployed to the yet-to-be Taiwan, and upon his return, he was stationed in Baltimore, where he remained and took a job with MetLife Insurance and got married. His father passed away in 1966 while Kelly was still in Baltimore. He and his wife returned to Brighton the following year.
He started working as a reporter and producer for an AM radio station that following year and made his mark not by covering mobsters, but by his hard-hitting coverage of Senator Teddy Kennedy's Chappaquiddick scandal that cost Mary Jo Kopechne her life. Kelly ran the story 3 hours before the other networks and in turn made a name for himself. The following year, he landed a job at WBZ where he became an award-winning journalist, and that is when he began rubbing elbows with the local wise guys.
Most people thought he was a tough Boston Irishman and didn't realize that he was a transplant. His sensationalistic delivery made him a hit. But the tall, bearded, and bespectacled newsman soon fell out of favor because of his harassment of Mayor Kevin White, and he was eventually cut loose by the news station. He was seen around town in the company of both Johnny and his brother Jimmy Modorano, as well as Howie Winter and Stevie Fleming.
So basically the entire Winter Hill crew except for Whitey Bulger.
Pretty much. But he always maintained that he only associated with them as part of his role as an investigative reporter. And during one of those meetings, he met Vincent Solmonti at his namesake lounge, Vincent's. The 2 men hit it off and even shared an apartment in the South End when Kelly was having problems at home. Solmonti gave him an open tab at Vincent's in exchange for a room, which Kelly took full advantage of, feeding his Pepsi habit. After months of looking for work, Kelly took up Solmonti's offer to help manage the Blackfriars.
And should we jump into Solmonti's bio now?
I gave you a perfect layup.
Remind me to thank you later.
Hey, I'm ignoring you.
That's the luxury you have of living thousands of miles apart from me. Okay, enough of the nonsense. St. Edward Salmonte was born on May 13th, 1943 in Quincy, Mass. To Edward Salmonte and Marianini Brandolini. In July of 1975, he married Camille Mojalevsky of Dearborn, Michigan. She was a sixth grade school teacher in Squanum, which for the non-local listeners is part of Quincy near Wollaston Beach. By that time, he was the owner of Vincent's, Blackfriars, Bunratty's, and Aliens, all located in Boston. He supposedly went to Newman Prep, which is where the problem kids who couldn't get into a normal prep school went. And why would you list that in your wedding announcement?
Hey, he also attended Nichols College out in Dudley.
Never heard of it.
Of course you haven't. You're a snob.
All right, moving on. Although Salmonte had no criminal record, in the 10 months leading up to his murder, he and the Blackfriars had been the subject of an FBI investigation into bankruptcy fraud, and Ted Harrington had assigned one of his assistants to the investigation. He had also been arrested by Swiss police in April of that year after using what they deemed to be a stolen credit card. The case was referred to Interpol, but the charges were dropped when the letter that Salmonte presented to the Swiss authorities was verified by the credit card holder, granting Salmonte the right to use the card.
Meanwhile, Kelly had taken on a freelance gig at Channel 56, which had not gotten off the ground yet at the time of his murder. But investigators believe that he was using his connection to the Moderanos to obtain information to further smear then-Mayor Kevin White's name in their ongoing feud.
Kevin White was the mayor of Boston for 4 terms, and he was a customer in my family's grocery store on Charles Street.
Well, that's great, but I doubt that going after the mayor in those days was winning any popularity contest, since he had already lost his job over it. Kelly had also had a run-in with Billy Bulger during a committee hearing a few years earlier, so he was definitely not winning any popularity contest with the politicians. Okay, let's move on to Freddie de la Vega now, and we'll loop back around to Salmonte in the aftermath portion.
Freddie was born in Cuba in 1944. Allegedly, Freddie de la Vega was one of the biggest coke dealers in New England. The DEA claimed that they had him under surveillance for months, observing him moving cocaine from Florida to Massachusetts. And why didn't they pick him up? Why didn't they take him in? Were they trying to make a case against someone that was further up the food chain? There wasn't much more information out there about him, and to top it off, none of his Somerville neighbors said they knew him or had ever even seen him.
Hey, would you admit to knowing someone who was just killed in such a violent manner?
Well, you have a point there.
Okay, well, let's move on to Peter Marath. Peter was born in Boston on December 2nd, 1946, to Francis Marath and Catherine May Perkins. He grew up at the Jamaica Plain end of Huntington Ave and remained in that area his entire life. At the age of 16, he was a passenger in a fatal car crash that took the life of a woman. He had no police record, although the police would later claim during the trial that he was involved in narcotics. And when pressed about the claim, the BPD admitted that the only connection they knew of for certain was the company he kept, as his car was observed in an area of known criminal activity.
Guilt by association.
Oh, maybe. We'll see. At the time of his murder, Peter had split up with his wife and was living in a basement apartment in the same part of JP, and was working as a manager and bartender at Shepherd's Pub, which was in within walking distance of his apartment. Allegedly, Salmonte owned that operation too. You have to figure he was dealing out of the bar for Salmonte. But like De La Vega, Peter supposedly didn't socialize with his neighbors, but had friends, quote unquote, dropping in at all hours. Maybe they were there to play backgammon too.
You are so cynical.
Hey, one of us has to be.
Better you than me. Let's move on to the last man, Charles Garabed Magarian. He was born in Alexandria, Egypt on September 29th, 1940 to Oneg Magarian and Takui Sahagian. His father passed before he and his mother made their way to Watertown, Mass.
Hey, she lived to be 89 years old.
Well, God bless her, but Charles wouldn't be so lucky as we know. He applied for and received a Social Security number in 1959 and graduated from Waltham High School in 1960, listed as a foreign student. In 1968, he went to work for Occidental Life Insurance and became a sales manager. His office was located at 99 High Street in downtown Boston, just a 5-minute walk from the Blackfriars, which is, I assume, is how he became a regular there.
Yeah. Well, maybe. But since he was living in North Andover by then, which isn't exactly around the corner, the work proximity makes sense for how he became a regular. And the backgammon makes sense, too, since he was said to be a highly skilled player and a sought-after teacher. In the months leading up to his death, he was featured in a local newspaper profiling his skills. He left behind a young wife and a daughter.
And that brings us to the massacre. The authorities never gave an exact time, but the murders took place sometime after 9 p.m. Jack Kelly was found lying face down with two bullets in his head. One man was seated in a chair, the others on the floor behind the desk and beside the desk. Salmonte, Kelly, and Merrith were all shot twice with a 12-gauge shotgun and a 25-caliber pistol. Magarian had been shot twice in the right temple with the 25. De La Vega had part of his face destroyed and was scalped with most of his brain blown out of his head by a single shotgun blast between the eyes. This is all according to the Suffolk County Medical Examiner. Not a single shotgun shell was recovered from the scene, only the rounds from the 25, which were in the victims.
Why were there no shotgun shells recovered?
Well, you have to assume that whoever did the shooting removed the shotgun shells to eliminate evidence. That way they couldn't link the weapon to another crime or specifically something unique about the weapon. And it also helps investigators recreate a crime scene. And if they're picked up, it would be harder to tell where the shooters were standing and the positions they were in. But they were in this tiny little crammed in space. So I don't think there was much left for the imagination as to where the shooters were.
Again, it was organized. It wasn't just some random rage shooting, as we'll talk about later.
Right. But you have to question how De La Vega was shot with a shotgun directly between the eyes at close range. That is awful. Like, to me, that feels so personal.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. But it's also interesting that Salmonte wasn't even supposed to be there that evening. He was triple booked. A friend of his, who was also a Quincy native, Christopher Petridge, was in New York at the Red Sox-Yankees game waiting for him. The Saugus police officer and Salmonte frequently attended out-of-state ball games together. Petridge had no idea that Salmonte wasn't planning to make it to the game. Friends said that Salmonte had always wanted to own one of the local sports teams.
One person that was supposed to be there but wasn't was Marilyn De Silva, the mother of three and longtime mistress of Stevie Flemmy, who Kelly had hired to work at the Blackfriars.
Hey, we'll get more into that when we discuss the theories. So initially, the authorities believed that Kelly and Magarian were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Salmonte's former business partner denied allegations that there were drugs involved, although he did concede that Vinny, as he called him, had a coke habit and that Kelly was quote-unquote smoking grass. According to the authorities, the killers only expected to find Merrith, De La Vega, and Salmonte that night, but they did state that all of the victims were known to the police.
Suffolk County DA Garrett Byrne was the first to refer to the slayings as a massacre. Supposedly 3 pounds of cocaine and $36,500 in cash was taken. A scale with residue of what was believed to be cocaine and marijuana was recovered at the scene.
Besides the government's long investigation in the months leading up to the slayings, rumors swirled that Salmonte, his attorney, and another unnamed lounge owner were planning to take over a local savings bank.
And how many of the so-called rumors were actually coming from Peter Auver, one of Special Agent Zip Connolly's favorite informants in those days?
Well, Auver, who was once our prior to his felony conviction, was also a Newman Prep kid.
I told you the problem kids went there.
Well, I believe you, but let's not make our listeners too angry.
Okay, I'm stopping.
Okay, but we'll come back to Aver when we get to the trial. But let's talk about Salmonte's business arrangements. In 1975, a Malden couple purchased the Blackfriars from Salmonte for $210,000. But after a month, they wanted out of the deal and demanded their deposit and legal fees back. Up until that time, Salmonte's partner was Dennis J. Mullins of Framingham. Mullins split from Salmonte and their business ventures just before the deal with the Medford couple. With the collapse of the sale, the Blackfriars remained in Salmonte's hands with a reopening in the summer of 76. Salmonte continued to operate the Blackfriars under the 105 Summer Inc. that he and Mullins had formed in July of 71. In September of 76, the liquor distributors came knocking, but Solmonti didn't want to pay, claiming he needed to get his finances in order after the tanked business deal.
On January 17, 1977, the Blackfriars was declared bankrupt with a debt of $108,000 and assets only totaling $13,300. And like magic, 4 days later, on January 21st, CamDeb Inc. was created. The Blackfriars liquor license was held by CamDeb Inc., with Solmonti listed as the president and treasurer. The clerk was Peter Krushevsky, a.k.a. Peter Blake, of Fairway Petroleum Corp. of Lansing, Michigan. You have to figure he was connected to Solmonti's wife, both by geography and ethnicity. And good old Peter was friends with Jimmy Chagra, drug smuggler extraordinaire and associate of Salvatore Caruana, and also linked to the Moroccan hashish smuggling up in Gloucester, which ties back to the homicides we covered last week.
It is also twisted, and hopefully our listeners were able to keep track of all of that. And you left out Woody Harrelson's dad in that mess.
Really, we need an org chart, a flow chart, a whiteboard, something.
But isn't that the same Krushevsky who was convicted of smuggling 27 tons of marijuana into Gloucester, Mass.?
He loved Gloucester and he loved smuggling drugs, and he is the one and only. He claimed the Vietnam Syndrome defense during his later trial. He was a decorated pilot like Barry Seal, same time frame, same backstory, same results, dead by 50. It all screams Caruana to me, though. The same for the Rhode Island guys that we discussed in last week's episode, including Bassett in New York. And I'm not saying that Caruana had anything to do with the killing of them, but the smuggling rings, he certainly did.
Well, just to wrap up Krushevsky briefly, he was out in Hawaii working at a food bank when his body washed ashore in 1996. It was deemed an accident, of course.
Sure it was. And looking at Krushevsky's involvement, it also makes perfect sense why Caruana took $50,000 from Solmonti's widow in early 1979, which he was supposedly using to cover the closing costs of his house. Now back to Solmonti's business structure for one more minute. There was also a CamDeb Investments Corp. that was just Solmonti, his attorney Albert Sakey, and Krushevsky that was formed on September 29th, 1976. CamDeb Inc., as I mentioned earlier, was formed on January 21st of 1977, and by the springtime, CamDeb purchased the temporarily defunct and bankrupt Blackfriars. Long story short, Solmonti sold himself his own business for $24,000. The liquor license for Vincent's was held by a corporation named 256 Commercial Street, Inc. Solmonti was listed as the president, along with officers Anthony J. Zangla, Dennis J. Mullins, and his attorney, again, Albert A. Sakey. And the couple still had a pending lawsuit against Solmonti when he was killed, and it's unclear if they ever actually received back the $65,000 that they were seeking.
Yeah, I know you think that they had some fantasy about being restaurant owners, but I just think that they were somehow in cahoots and it was some kind of a money laundering scheme or some way to get the debts dismissed.
It's certainly possible, but we're never going to know the answer for that. Okay, let's get back to the investigation. While the BPD and the assortment of other three-letter agencies were busy trying to solve the massacre, Jerry Angiulo and company had cobbled together their own dragnet and were carrying out an internal investigation of sorts. The intense scrutiny that the local criminal world was operating under certainly wasn't good for business, and they definitely weren't inclined to take the fall for the massacre.
To be a fly on the wall.
No question.
Then, just 2 weeks later, on July 12th, William Iardi and Robert Italiano were arrested for the slayings, but the DA's office said that the investigation wasn't over as they believed that one or two more individuals participated in the murders. The police had been trailing them around the clock since just 2 days after the massacre. A sawed-off shotgun was recovered at Iardi's apartment, along with the Boston Phoenix newspaper, with the headline, quote, "The Friends of Jack Kelly," unquote. The friends included Jimmy Modarano. The duo were indicted in late July.
The pretrial hearings commenced in February of the following year. The DA's office made it clear in their opening statement that both Solmonti and Kelly had long-running relationships with both Modarano brothers, and that Solmonti was connected to Howie Winter in cocaine trafficking. by that time, Howie was facing the race-fixing charges. Is that our next episode?
No, we have to finish this one, then the hit parade of 78, and finally Howie. But before we get into the trial, let's get a bit of background on our two hapless defendants.
Deal. So William Nicholas Urardi was born in Boston on December 12, 1945, to Paul Urardi and Anna Gladys Stewart. The first arrest I could find was for drunk driving when he was 18. In October of 1970, he was arrested for possession of an unlicensed handgun, possession of an unnamed narcotic substance, and a hypodermic needle. Less than 2 months later, he was pinched with 160 bags of heroin during a bust in Marblehead.
Well, I guess we know what the unnamed substance was. Urardi was released on $10,000 bail, and the case was bound over to Superior Court. But less than a year later, he was busted again. And on the same day, his trial was supposed to start, this time as a suspect in an armed robbery. During the arrest, of course, more heroin was confiscated. On November 19th, a judge freed him on $5,000 bail, even though he was already out on $15,000 for the other two cases.
Can you say Bail Reform Act?
Hey, that hadn't happened yet. Then he got pinched again the same day for an attempted B&E on a house in Lynn.
You can't make this stuff up. You really can't.
He pleaded guilty the following month on the B&E charges and was sentenced to 5 to 10 years. Eight other 3 to 5 year sentences for the heroin and the paraphernalia that were to run concurrent with the 5 to 10 year sentence. He was to be placed on a year's probation upon his release. After that, he avoided arrest until the Blackfriars.
Enough of that. Now, for Robert James Italiano, he was born in Boston on May 15, 1942, to Salvatore Italiano and Ida Martello. Robert's first arrest that I could find was also at the age of 18 for narcotics possession, an unidentified white powder and cough syrup, to be more specific. He wouldn't be arrested again until January of 1972, when he was picked up in a gambling raid along with one of the Cresta boys. 7 months before the massacre, Italiano himself was a victim. His companion, disgraced former Boston police officer Mario Marzano, was killed by a shotgun blast at 2:10 a.m. on Saratoga Street in East Boston. Italiano took a hit in his right knee.
Well, I guess we missed that in the hit parade episode of 1977. And of course, the murder was never solved. But 5 years earlier, Mario was nearly killed in another shooting. And then tragically, his brother, Alfred, who was a defense witness for Urardi, was shot to death execution style in his East Boston backyard just 11 months after he testified.
All right. So Alfred testified that he had seen Urardi at a wake the evening that I'm going to say Zachary, and you want to say Zachary, claimed Urardi had confessed on tape to participating in the massacre. The tape was played in the courtroom for all to hear, and anyone that knew Italiano was not convinced that the voice they were hearing was his.
During the hearings, the prosecutors claimed that they were attempting to sell the 3 pounds of cocaine that were allegedly stolen during the massacre.
It was the 1970s. Who wasn't buying cocaine?
Well, I don't know, but now I'm doubting even more of the narrative. So the authorities got a warrant based on the fact that they were going to buy the coke from Italiano and Urardi in a sting operation on June 14th for $65,000. But instead, they decided to arrest them a day earlier. And of course, no coke was recovered. It just makes you want to scream.
Well, and it was July 14th, not June 14th. You let that slip. So they used that as a premise to obtain the arrest warrants. But obviously, they knew there was no coke. So they had to arrest them the day ahead of time. They probably arrested them the minute they had the warrants in their hand. And if you think that was bad enough, wait until we come back around to the recordings, and then you'll really want to scream.
Okay, well, speaking of screaming, let's come back to Peter Robert Aver, our Connolly's informant du jour. Previously, he had testified at the extortion trial of two state liquor commissioners. Aver claimed to be an acquaintance of all 5 victims and of the 2 accused murderers. By this time, he was in witness protection with his wife and 2 young children. Zip Connolly took credit for, quote-unquote, turning Aver around with the help of a state parole officer.
Little fun fact that Aver owned the Emerald House in Randolph, where he would put, like, expensive booze bottles on the back of the bar, but he would fill the bottles with rock gut.
That's nice. Yeah. He also claimed that he decided to cooperate with the authorities because he was tired of paying bribes in order to stay in business.
If he wasn't doing shady shit, he wouldn't have had to pay, bribe anyone, now would he?
Hey, believe me when I tell you, that man was a sociopath.
And speaking of sociopaths, Connolly had testified about Aver, saying that he was a big better at Suffolk Downs, a horse owner, drove a fancy Cadillac, and had wads of cash stuffed in his pockets.
Connolly said a lot of things about Aver, and I get the impression that he was using Aver to do his dirty work here. And I'll just say that in my opinion, Zip Connolly deliberately misled the court and derailed the case solely to protect his golden boys.
Very highly likely.
So Aver claimed he went to talk to Robert Italiano while Italiano was locked up at Charles Street Jail at Connolly's behest. Italiano reportedly spilled his guts to Aver and told him, quote unquote, everything. In this version of events, Miles Connors was also a customer of Freddie de la Vega's. Freddie, in an attempt to get more money out of Connors and Italiano, told them that he had a deal set up with Solmonte worth $100,000. Instead, Connors decided to just arrange to steal the goods and gave the score to Italiano. In return, Miles was to get half.
Good old-fashioned intel laundering, thanks to the FBI. Some witnesses intentionally peddling what they were told to, and others being misled into thinking they were doing the right thing, all to sell a certain narrative.
Exactly. So here's how the story went. Italiano got the details about the score from Walter Lafrenieri, the manager of the Mousetrap Lounge, who was also a buyer of from De La Vega's. Mm-hmm. He, Nicky Femia, Gene Giangrande met at Walter's house to come up with a plan to interrupt the deal and steal the coke. Nobody was supposed to die, but it all went wrong because everybody was high and Femia was, quote unquote, extremely high. Italiano and Giangrande waited outside. Walter let the others in. They were wearing ski masks, but Kelly somehow recognized Nicky Femia and called him out by name. Magarian leapt up from his chair and Femia shot him. Femia continued shooting and Billy Iardi joined in, and that's how everyone ended up dead.
It's awfully hard to shoot someone in double tap formation in the temple while they're leaping.
Okay, so there's some holes in the story. I'm not saying it's 100% accurate, but if you substitute the names for Winter Hill members, say Miles, quote unquote, is Whitey, and the shooters were Stevie and Johnny, or maybe Nicky Femia was a shooter.
Well, Nicky Femia, even with the ski mask, would be easy to recognize by the build. You know, it's why Dad was the getaway driver and smot him a mile away. So I can understand somebody figuring out that was Nicky under a ski mask. But whatever the case, it was certainly intel laundering at its finest.
I'm just going to say that Zip Connolly had it out for Miles Connors.
Well, Miles Connors wasn't winning any popularity contest with his brethren either.
Well, that's for sure.
Okay. I want to get back to Marilyn DeSilva and her testimony during the grand jury hearings about why she didn't show up at the Blackfriars that evening.
More soap opera worthy stuff.
More like a telenovela. So Jack Kelly hired Stevie Flemmi's longtime mistress, Marilyn DeSilva, to work as a waitress at the Blackfriars. She met Flemmi in 1974 when she was working at Chandler's, which was partly owned by Howie Winter. Her best friend, Alexis, was dating Nicky Femia at the time of the massacre. She testified during the grand jury hearing that she wasn't there, but not why she wasn't there. She had told Flemmi that she was going to the Blackfriars that night, but he told her not to go. Years later, after Stevie was locked up for good, she claims that he admitted to her during one of their prison visits that Femia had been one of the killers that night.
Well, you know, I still think that the Deb part of Solmonte's two Cam Deb companies was Deb as in Deborah Davis.
I knew you weren't going to let that one go without slipping it in. And I agree 100% that the Cam part was definitely Solmonte's wife, Camille. I looked to see if Krzyzewski or the attorney Sakey had any Debs close to them, and no. I even looked at Caruana, and no Debs. So you're probably right.
Yeah, so Stevie was a silent partner in Blackfriars.
Like I said, you're most likely right about that. Anyhow, Stevie's girlfriend or girlfriends weren't the only ones in the mix. Solmonte's girlfriend also testified.
You mean his wife Camille, right?
No, his girlfriend. The headline was fantastic. Barmaid was cocaine tester.
Charming.
Alveria Farrell, Salmonte's girlfriend, bartender, and his personal cocaine tester was granted immunity in exchange for her story. Just like the policeman who was waiting for Salmonte at the Yankees-Red Sox game, Alveria, too, had a date with Salmonte. She said they had plans to go to a movie together. She last spoke to him at 8 p.m. after she called the bar. They obviously never met up, and she continued to call every half an hour until giving up at 1 a.m. Now, here's the part that you're going to like. She testified that Salmonte was buying coke from Merrith and Margarian.
Say, I told you he wasn't squeaky clean like you wanted to believe. You just have a soft spot for Armenians because you live there.
Okay, so I'm biased. She went on to say that all of the men were heavy coke users and that there was no way that Salmonte had a buy set up for that evening because he would have asked her to be there to sample the wares. She went on to elaborate about Aver's relationship with Salmonte. According to her, there was quote unquote a lot of bad blood between the two men, and that the last time she saw him was at Blackfriars the day before the massacre.
He was already in witness protection by then.
He didn't go in until after the massacre. His story about not wanting to pay bribes was totally BS. It was more about him saving his own hide.
For sure. The BPD's ballistics expert also testified the day Miss Farrell was regaling us with the story of her sommelier skills.
I like that. Instead of those little silver taste fins that the sommeliers used to wear, she must have had a little silver Coke spoon around her neck.
Thanks for the visual.
You're welcome.
The expert said that the two guns and one shotgun that were recovered from Iardi and Italiano couldn't have been used in the murders. The handguns were antiques and the shotgun was rusted.
Belmonte's girlfriend said that he always carried a handgun with a 10-inch barrel in his briefcase, but it was not recovered.
What kind of gun has a 10-inch barrel?
It had to be some sort of AR-15.
Okay, gotcha. There was one other person that day that testified. He was an accountant from Framingham who claimed that he overheard on several occasions Salmonte and Kelly talking about drug deals.
I find it hard to believe that they were that careless, but if they were all using drugs themselves, then who knows? After a month-long trial, the jury returned not guilty verdicts on both men on April 9th. Italiano was cut loose that evening, but Iardi was transferred to the custody of the Danvers police, who had a warrant on him for weapons possession.
How many warrants did that man have?
You've got me. Italiano's mother burst out in the courtroom that she knew it wasn't her son's voice on the recordings.
Well, you mean Zachari, whatever his name was, the self-proclaimed criminal and heroin addict lied? Shocker.
The public didn't know for sure until the following year. In April of 1980, it was finally revealed during a hearing that Zachari had convinced his friend, Ronald Cresta, the son of Phil Cresta, to pretend to be Italiano and told him to confess to the slayings while Zachari, was wearing a wire. He then handed over the recording to the authorities, stating it was a conversation between him and Italiano. Cresta confessed to the scheme during the April hearing. Zachari had been denying the perjury allegations since the time of the trial of Iardi and Italiano, and it vindicated Marzano's statement that on the evening Italiano was supposedly confessing to Zachari, he was actually at the wake.
Well, it's interesting to me that Marzano was executed the month before that was officially revealed.
True. It could have been related since everyone at that point knew Zachari had cooked up the story.
Well, back to the immediate aftermath of the acquittal. On July 1st, another arrest was made, this time a former Joe Barboza crew member and at the time Winter Hill member Nikki Femia. As we mentioned earlier, Femia was dating the best friend of one of Stevie Flemmi's girlfriends.
According to later statements, initially Whitey Bulger told Special Agent Zip Connolly not to consider Femia as a suspect in the massacre. But when Femia and Bulger had a falling out, he went back to Connolly and told him that Femia had indeed been one of the shooters. Whitey wasn't the only one feeding information to Connolly about the massacre. Stevie Flemmi supposedly told Connolly that the shooters were Femia, Iardi, and Italiano. Femia still remains listed as a suspect to this day, but there was never any tangible proof presented.
It's interesting because it's similar to what Aver claimed, like the names.
Yes, yes. Yes, because again, they were all given the same story to tell.
Well, I guess that's what my point.
Or it was documented that way. I don't think Stevie went to Connolly and gave him that statement. I think that was a statement that Connolly stuck in the file because he had a cover for Stevie and Whitey.
Right. Yeah, it's the same names. It's just interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, the court seemed to agree, and they released Femia on a nominal bail on July 20th. The charges were dismissed against him in September. And we'll do a full profile on Femia when we cover his murder in the hit parade of 1983. But you can hear more about his backstory in season one, I think in the Barboza episodes.
Yes. Let's move on with the aftermath. In early 1981, the BPD released a statement that they were going to reopen the case as there were interviews that had never been completed. And of course, nothing ever came of that.
And as we mentioned earlier, at the time of Solmonti's death, he had been the subject of both state and federal investigations. He owed the Mass Department of Revenue some $26,000 in back taxes. And the company that purchased Vincent's still had issues transferring the liquor license from Solmonti's name to their organization as late as the spring of 1982.
In June of 1983, the authorities tried to tie Solmonti to two specific drug trafficking cases. The first stemmed from documents that were discovered in Solmonti's office after the massacre that tracked a $500,000 investment in a marijuana venture that was supposed to net $20 million in return. The second was the hashish smuggling scheme with Krushevsky that we spoke about earlier.
Yeah, the 10,000 pounds smuggled from Morocco to Gloucester in 78, which I know is one of the threads that you believe links Caruana to more than just the trafficking.
I still think that Caruana had more of a hand in at least the decision-making about which one of the smugglers or dealers was going to be taken out. I'll have plenty of time to expand on my theories when we profile Caruana next season.
I hear you, and I find the similarities in business structures to be very compelling. The setup is very similar to Russian shell corporations we've looked at previously.
For sure. The accepted list of suspects were and are the other Winter Hill guys. Hold on a second. For sure, the accepted list of suspects were and are the other Winter Hill guys, Whitey, Stevie, Johnny Mutterano, Jimmy Mutterano, Howie Winter, and Louis Latif. There was the story about Whitey getting the photos of the massacre from Connolly immediately after the slayings in order to shake down Ted Berenson, who had borrowed $60,000 from Solmonti just months before, a tempting source of revenue. So Whitey showed up and laid out the photos and told Berenson that he had killed the quintet and would do the same to him if he didn't pay up.
Yeah, but if it was the Winter Hill crew, why didn't Stevie use it as a bargaining tool along with the other murders he copped to, some of which I still don't believe that they committed? But was it because the massacre was somehow more egregious than the other horrific murders they committed?
That's what I was thinking at first, but I don't really think it was that. There's no rhyme or reason to what True. Stevie copped to, Johnny copped to, really, there isn't.
Well, Howie had been sentenced to a short jail stint in February of 79 on charges of forcing local bars to place his pinball machines in their establishment. Well, we can expand on the possibility of Howie calling the hit when we do his episode in a couple of weeks.
Deal. Either of the Mutteranos would have been able to waltz right in without permission, as could have Stevie, without any issue, as they were both friendly with at least Kelly and Solmonti. Maybe Da Silva's testimony that Stevie warned her not to go there that night and that they were together wasn't to implicate him in having some prior knowledge, but rather to cover for him by giving him an alibi that they were together.
Well, it's as plausible as any other theory out there. We should submit a FOIA for Solmonti's file just for the investigation leading up to his murder.
I think you should do that.
Okay, the last widely accepted suspect, Louis Latif, would meet his end less than a year after the trial ended, actually a month after Marzano was killed and just days after Zakari's perjury scheme was exposed. And that makes him a strong suspect in my mind because I think of the timing of his murder as cleaning up loose ends.
And it's always been said that he was killed by his own crew. We need to look deeper at that when we prep for that episode.
Deal. Okay, we got to wrap this up. This went way long.
All right, sorry for the episode being so long, but I didn't want to split it into two this time.
Okay, I'm not complaining too much.
Well, hopefully some of our listeners made it to the end. And if you did, please share any theories or stories that you guys might have heard about it.
Thank you. Please do.
Thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye.